Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome this evening. A couple of weeks ago, a dear friend who's been a guest on the show many times and one of the most brilliant thinkers I know in this here United States of America, and one of the greatest lawyers I know, and a law professor, Sherrilyn Ifill, sent me an email and said, you really need to read this article written by one of my colleagues about something that I never thought about before, which was cyber sexual harassment. And so I read the article, and the article was written by Danielle Citrone. And Danielle Citrone is a professor at the same law school, University of Maryland School of Law, who researches into cyber gender harassment and hostile environment women face online. She wrote a paper, which will be published elsewhere somewhere soon, called It's Not Trivial, that I read, and wrote another piece called Cyber Civil Rights, and talked about the horrendous nature of sexual harassment, but worse, that takes place on the web. And I actually was pretty blown away after I read the article, and then my producer, Jessica Phillips, flooded me with work by many women who are on the web, and two of them are also our guests this hour, LaToya Peterson and Jill Filipovic. And I was really shocked. I mean, I figured it existed, but I didn't figure it existed at this extent. But knowing how racism and sexism in America bubbles under the surface everywhere we are, I shouldn't be so shocked as I was. This hour we're going to talk about cyber sexual harassment and the nature of that. And it's one thing if you're in somebody's face in a sexual harassment, but when it's online, maybe people don't take it as seriously for whatever reason, but the people who are the victims of that do, and they're more than you think. So we're joined this hour by Danielle Citrone, who is professor of law at the University of Maryland School of Law, who wrote the article that got us started on this whole idea. LaToya Peterson joins us. She's a Silver Spring, Maryland-based blogger whose work can be seen at racialicious.com. So you can Google that as you listen to us, where she's the editor. Her writing has appeared a recent anthology, Yes Means Yes, Visions of Female Sexual Power and a World Without Rape. And Jill Filipovic, do I say that right? Filipovic, right? Filipovic. I got it. Good. It's a good ethnic name, Filipovic. Jill Filipovic, who blogs at Feministe, FEMINISTE.US. And her writing has also appeared in Huffington Post, Alternet, the Yale Journal of Law and Feminism, and many other places. Her writing will also appear in the anthology Yes Means Yes, Visions of Female Sexual Power and the World Without Rape. And welcome all three of you. It's a pleasure to have you on the show with us.
Yeah, thanks so much having. Yeah.
And join us here at 410-319-8888 to join in on this conversation, or write to us at steinershow@gmail.com, 410-319-8888. Let's talk about sexual and racist harassment on the Internet that exists, that we do not think about it existing in the depth that it does. But I bet you that many of you women who are listening to this show now have experienced it. And either slept it aside, not thought about it, tried to put it under the rug, not talked about it, or perhaps have talked about it and don't know what to do about it or how to respond to it. And we're all on the web all the time now. Every day, I mean, our lives are on this thing. So let's start this conversation. And let me start, Danielle, with you, since it's your paper that kind of got me thinking, got us thinking about doing this program, starting this program out. Talk about the depth of this. I guess that's what really kind of shocked me, that when I read your essay that you described different kinds of gender harassment on the web. You talked about how it's invisible to the law, that people are really doing anything about it. So just talk, give us an overview here, then we'll bring our other guests in.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, the question of how pervasive is this, I can sort of describe that and then talk about the different types and forms of cyber harassment we're seeing increasingly online of women. Apparently, 40% of all female users of the internet have experienced some form of cyber harassment. And so according to a recent study, individuals writing under female pseudonyms online are 25 times more likely to be attacked with sexual threats of violence than individuals writing under male pseudonyms. And so the kind of cyber harassment that I'm focusing on sort of takes three central forms. Individuals terrorize women on the web. They threaten violence. They urge others to physically harm women and provide the women's home addresses. They post doctored photographs of women being raped and strangled, and they post the women's social security numbers, sort of opening them up to identity theft or making them more vulnerable. The second central way is that they interfere with women's work opportunities, sending damaging statements and emails to future employers, manipulating search engines to ensure that damaging statements are really prominent in searches of women's names. And then the third thing is that they use technology to force women offline, engaging in distributed denial of service attacks to literally shut down women's blogs and websites. And so, and usually the attacks come sort of in all three altogether. It's sort of the perfect storm of using technology to force women offline, threatening violence, and then interfering with their ability to network and, you know, put their ideas together with others online.
LaToya Peterson and Jill Filipovich, I'd like you both to join in here, and I start with LaToya, then go to Jill. I mean, your lives are on the web. At least, I mean, that you put your work on the web. That's the way you express yourself, or through your sites, and they're both very powerful sites. And I would encourage our listeners, as we're talking, to go to racialicious.com and feminist.us and look at their work if you have not seen it yet. My producer Jessica Phillips says she reads this work every day, and she turned me on to it. And I encourage you all to go read this as we're talking. But LaToya, talk about it from your perspective, and then Jill, and then we'll get into some specifics.
Oh well, thank you so much. Well, in essence, being a woman online is already a very challenging space to be in, because especially if you happen to, as Danielle said, use a female-identified username or a username that people would identify with a woman, you are automatically targeted for a certain type of attack. And here's a great example of one. I published a piece by a male Muslim writer I know, and his first name is Jahan Zeb. But because his first name is Jahan Zeb, people can't really associate it, and a lot of people tend to think he's female.
Mm-hmm.
And the attacks that we get on his pieces are definitely, they don't attack his argument, they attack his gender, calling him, you know, one of these whiny feminist women who just doesn't, you know, has no idea about the real world. Someone called him a fat lesbian, and it's like, This is a guy who's writing this. He does have very feminist allied opinions. I'm not sure if he identifies as a feminist or not. But it's interesting to see how just the change of a name defers more respect and more authority to men online. And then you get into the whole idea of what's appropriate for women to talk about online and what's not appropriate for women to talk about online.
Mm-hmm.
So it can be very difficult for women when we're talking about political issues, we're talking about racial issues, we're talking about anything other than what's sanctioned to be woman material, like feminism, sex, sexuality, home, and homemaking, that we start getting more challenges and more pushback from male users who, for some reason, find it a lot easier to discount a woman's opinion than they would if that opinion was written by a man or someone who is, who you can't observe their gender based on their username. And in fact, a lot of the female readers of my site use gender neutral usernames because of this kind of harassment, because they want to be taken seriously.
And Jill Filipovich, I mean, you're also you're a lawyer, is that right?
Yes.
You've graduated from NYU.
Mm-hmm.
And from what I read on your site today, and yesterday, that you are, I mean, you have been, you don't just write about this, you've been a victim of this.
Yeah, I'm one of the people discussed in Danielle's essay, or in
right.
her paper.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, the blog I write for is a fairly large and old feminist blog, and so we get targeted for this stuff quite a bit. So, I mean, the blog has been shut down by anonymous attacks, people that refresh images constantly and exceed your bandwidth and shut you down. I was also personally targeted on some law school-related message boards where, you know, my name and my phone number, I don't know my phone number, my email address, my AOL screen name, all of that was published. People would publish Jill's sightings about seeing me around school and say what I was wearing or, you know, if I looked at someone sideways, that was on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
And that is particularly intimidating when it's people that you go to school with or know, but you don't actually know who they are. And I guess it made me a little bit more aware of the fact that a lot of the stuff that we get in our comments on the blog, you know, may seem kind of innocuous because you don't know who these people are. They can just be obnoxious drive-bys, but you don't know who these people are. And, mm-hmm. you know, at the end of the day, it is difficult to sort of feel safe and to always be able to write it off as, you know, they're strangers, they're just people in their parents' basement. You know, when it's law students who do this stuff too, and it's lawyers who do this stuff too, and it's people who you can't always categorize as just, you know, internet crazies. And so I think that's, you know, one thing that's particularly scary about online harassment is that there's really no way for your average, you know, internet user to tell who it is that's leaving these comments and how close they may or may not be to you in your real life.
I mean, this is the thing about the internet, the use of the internet. I mean, it's become where people communicate on all kinds of levels, and that's what we use all the time. Everybody has Blackberries, everybody has an iPhone or something that keeps you connected 24 hours a day. And that whether it's Facebook or your emails, whatever it is, we're always connected. So it's easy to find another human being.
Right.
When I read that about this stuff, it was almost as if people were, I mean, people are, it's akin to being physically attacked.
It can lead to physical attack. That's right. I mean, when you put up and you post someone's home address with the suggestion that they're interested in anonymous sex, which they're clearly not, it has led to sort of posts on Juicy Campus have led to attacks on women. So it's led to offline stalking and physical attack.
We're talking about the question of cybersexual harassment on the air this hour. Number here is 410-319-8888. It's a much deeper problem than we think. Women are harassed all the time in person in this country and around the world. I was reading an article this morning in New York Times front page. It was about young women going to school who have acid thrown in their face. And so that's an extreme physical expression of a feeling that people have about women who have power or we sense have power. And it's being played out on the web in some very serious ways. We'd love to have your thoughts. If you've experienced it, think about this issue. It's an issue that's not talked very much about in public, and we're trying to bring it to the airwaves now. We're here with Daniel Citrone, who's a professor of law at the University of Maryland School of Law, who focuses on this area. LaToya Peterson has a blog called racialicious.com, and Jill Filipovich works at feminist.us.com, feminist.com. And writes on many other journals, as does LaToya. They both have their work appearing in a new anthology coming out calling Yes Means Yes, Visions of Female Sexual Power and a World Without Rape. The number here is 410-319-8888. You can write to us at steinershow@gmail.com. And we do have emails coming in, oddly enough, since this is a show about cyberspace, and they're coming in by email. Where do we start here? Let's start with this one. Elizabeth writes in saying, This is for the discussion on cyber harassment. I'm a communications PhD student who's developing a focus on online communities and identifications with avatars. Quote, in some online avatar creation, typically sexualized attributes, for example, especially bust or hip size, can be customized. This allows individuals to option to create ideal, realistic, or hypersexualized avatars. Do you feel that this is appropriately used as a medium for creative expression within an online community, or does it seem to lead to increased gender harassment by allowing for more voluntary differences which can be noticed by potential harassers? Interesting question.
Interesting question.
Danielle, do you want to go first?
Sure. I mean, if you want me to, I can. I can take it.
I'll jump in afterwards.
Okay, go.
That's great. I think we're going to see sort of the gendered harassment, obviously, that we see, you know, offline. We're going to see it online. We're going to see it in the play spaces of the net in Second Life. What's really interesting, too, about Second Life is that you could have a male playing a female. And so I guess the interesting set of questions is how much harassment are we seeing on, you know, sites like Second Life so that people are playing these gender roles and repeating and recurring some of this harassment, and they may not indeed even be, the victims may indeed be men. It's just an interesting, but I don't know actually some of the statistics about what's going on in Second Life, though. I think it's an interesting set of questions.
LaToya, Jill, are you aware of anything on Second Life?
Definitely. I'm actually a avid video gamer.
Okay.
I write about video games for Cerise Magazine.
Why am I not surprised? Go ahead.
I know. Which is really strange. I'm like, you're a black woman video gamer. But I got all kinds of weird hobbies. It's fine. So I love video games, but when you go into these online areas, you go into these forums, and, you know, you're bombarded by racist and sexist drivel, and that seemed to be, it's somewhat accepted more in the gaming sphere of the community, though a lot of the older writers and people who are, you know, people who are the older gamers, 20 to 30, and they're going, okay, this isn't really cool anymore. And then you have a lot of people who can hide behind their anonymity and say a lot of things. But on to the direct question of the avatars, this is an argument that I hear often, because they try to argue that if women didn't try to make themselves look different or stand out or be different, then they wouldn't be targeted for harassment, which I feel is extremely problematic. Are you saying that just by the fact that I chose to have a female avatar to represent myself, I have opened myself up for harassment to do so? Why would that even be why is that the logical progression of thought? You know, since she decided to identify herself as female, she is asking for it. And you hear those same conversations. We talk about race in this digital, in the video games digital space. You know, if you didn't identify yourself as black or as Asian or whatnot, nobody would have known. And so it's your fault for pointing out that you're different. And that means we have the right to mock you, to ridicule you, to harass you. And I feel like that's extremely problematic. In terms of avatars, one of my co-writers on Cerise, she blogs under Takanji. Her name is Andrea Rubenstein. And she wrote this great thing about idealizing digital bodies and digital forms, and how, in general, because of our societal norms, when we draw people, when we illustrate, and we do things with avatars, we always put them toward what we think the ideal should be. So for men, they're normally extremely muscular, tall, fit. You rarely ever see any deviation from that body type. And for women, we're supposed to be slender and attractive, but only attractive to what I suppose, I think she describes as like the male gaze version of attractiveness. Very large bust, very small waist.
Did you say male gaze, G-A-Z-E, is that what you said?
Yes, male gaze version of attractiveness. So this is very limited version of attractiveness. What we always hear when we talk about video game avatars, why can't we have a female video game fighter that's wearing, you know, battle armor instead of a bikini and a thong and a sword? Like, why does it, you know, it doesn't fit her job, it doesn't fit her job class, it doesn't fit what she's doing, and it can't be fun to run around in high heels for 15 levels. You know, it doesn't make logical sense, but there's this idea that if we're drawing something, it has to fit up to this exaggerated version of the ideal that society mandates. And that's one of the reasons why the avatar issue can be really, really thorny.
So, I'm sorry, Jill, do you want to jump in on this as well before we...
You can go ahead. I actually do not play video games.
So. Okay, Jill, I won't hold it against you.
So, but what I'm thinking, listening to the three of you is that when we're talking about the cyber sexual harassment, is that what is it about this world that we've created, that has been created around us, that we all are part of, especially the younger you are, the more you're part of it, that seems to create almost a hyper-extension of the kind of sexist or racist nature that people are afraid to do in real life, in real time. Jill?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, as you kind of allude to, the anonymity aspect of it makes it a lot easier for people to say, you know, what they might otherwise think, but that in their real lives they may face serious repercussions for saying out loud or for doing. You know, in day-to-day, women face harassment, you know, and poor treatment all the time, even offline. You know, and the internet just sort of becomes, I guess, a more consolidated place for it, because you have so many people, you know, and you have that sort of lack of, I guess, social norms that inhibit people from saying things out loud day to day.
I just throw it out to the three of them. Just think about this. I was listening to you, Jill, and I was thinking about how the internet has done has created an ability to kind of titillate us with anything we want. It's like being a 5-year-old dropped in a chocolate factory, you know, and or anybody else who happens to love chocolate being dropped in a chocolate factory. But it's almost. You can not control the appetite. In other words, porn is right there. You want it, you log on. You can buy it, you can look at it, you can play with it on the net, you can, or whatever that happens to be. And that the idea that you can feel dominant over a woman and say anything you want without being seen and then destroy people's lives that way, I mean, so I wonder, how do you get to this? How do you get to addressing something that people don't know how to control.
I mean, some of the difficulty is just what Jill underscores is the anonymity. And so it, you don't suffer any social stigma for doing it. You don't feel like you're going to get caught. People are images. And so some of the digging down into how we resolve this problem is the anonymity problem. And at the same time, website operators are completely immune for the postings of others. And so if they don't slow down abusive behavior and take off, let's say, on comment sections or just take off abusive behavior and it stays up, it's like a snowball. It encourages more and more. And so some of the difficulty lies in the anonymity of the net, which is built into the structure of the net.
Because what we're talking about here in some sense, LaToya, when I was reading the stuff that all three of you have written, is that I mean, the stuff being manipulated by people on the outside, they could take your body, go if they knew how to get into, if people know how to kind of break into people's websites, mm-hmm. like they do in companies, they could break in, take your identity, which they do to people, and put your body in all kinds of positions with pictures on the web, and then really go after people in that sense. And I could see that'd be a very frightening situation to be in.
It's like reputation theft, but very difficult to track down the perpetrators.
It's hard to, you can't, right.
It's like a cat and mouse game. You can try to find them, and sometimes you can, but so often you can't. Because ISPs like delete within 60 days IP addresses. And if websites aren't keeping IP addresses, then it's nearly impossible to track down the perpetrators.
Mm-hmm. Even if you have the IP address, it can be almost impossible to do it. Like one of my contributors actually got harassed very recently. And again, I blog under my real name. So do many of my regular correspondents. But a lot of our guest contributors don't. And they blog under their pen names or whatever they choose. And this person, Paula, had written a wonderful piece talking about the nature of covert racism versus overt racism.
Mm-hmm.
And how sometimes it feels like covert racism is harder to deal with because there isn't that direct item. This isn't a direct thing where you can point to and be like, okay, that was racist. This person said they're not, you know, going to serve me because I'm Asian. You know, with the covert racism, it's more like, okay, well, is this person snubbing me in the store? Are they not talking to me? Are they not giving me service because of my race? Is it because of something else? Are they upset that day? Is there a problem? Why is it that when my white husband came in, they decided to see me? So she was discussing all of these issues that come up in a very measured and respectful way that resonated with a lot of my readers. And then somebody decided to post how much they hated what she wrote and how, you know, she was dragging the entire anti-racism movement down by making things up and, mm-hmm. you know, all of this ridiculous stuff, which I deleted because it violated our comment moderation policy and I didn't think about it anymore. I found out later that person went to Paula's own site and left messages trying to out her location, her last name, the name of her husband, the name of her child.
That's pretty scary.
And threatened to find her child's school and go and visit and make sure to teach her a lesson.
I'd like to open the phones if I could. We just heard LaToya Peterson, whose site is racialicious.com. Jill Filipovich is with us. On the site, feministe.us. I'm spelling it out so you can look it up while we're talking here. Danielle Citron is with us, whose articles on cyber sexual harassment got us started in this conversation today. Number here is 410-319-8888. Write to us at steinershow@gmail.com. And Renee in Niagara Falls, Ontario, you're on the air.
Hi, Joe. Hi, LaToya. I'm great. Huge fan of both of you.
Wait, Renee from Womanist Musings. Hi.
Hi. calling in to ask a question regarding race and sexism. As you know, this is a huge issue with me, and I was wondering how you feel that we can come together as bloggers to fight the kind of harassment that women of color deal with on the Internet.
That's a very powerful question. LaToya, why don't we go around the room, start with LaToya, then go to Jill and Danielle.
Great. I feel like as women of color and as bloggers, one of the biggest things we can do is refuse to remain silent about these situations and when they happen. That's one of the reasons why I posted about what was happening to Paula, because a lot of times you're encouraged to be quiet about it. If someone's harassing you, oh, it's just that person on the Internet, they're just screwing around, they don't really mean it, it's fine. And then what happens if somebody shows up at your door? Like that, you know, it's terrifying. And people need to understand, one, the frequency of how often this happens, because often when you talk to, particularly when you talk to men in online spaces, they're like, yeah, it happens to everybody once in a while. And they just really do not understand the frequency that this can be a daily threat that we get. And you never quite know which of these threats is going to materialize, which one's going to be real. And secondly, to condemn that behavior and to talk about things that happen to your friends online. I make sure to always reference what happened to Kathy Sierra and how she felt the need to take her blog down, even though she's writing about software and nothing even remotely controversial.
Just because she's a woman.
Because she's a woman, and because someone felt like they could make obscene gestures or talk about, you know, cutting her head off or doing all kinds of horrible things to her. And I feel like we have to keep reminding people these things have happened, these things are happening, these things will continue to happen as long as we allow them to be acceptable and as long as we allow these people to operate in silence and anonymity and reward them by either silencing ourselves or taking down our blogs.
Jill Filipovich?
Well, I mean, I think LaToya's point of speaking out is really important. I also think pooling our resources can be incredibly helpful. You know, when my name was being, you know, written about on these law school message boards, a lot of feminist bloggers came together and they did a Google bomb for me, which basically meant that they wrote a bunch of posts all using my full name so that when you would Google me, more things would come up, you know, than Jill Filipovich, you know, deserves to be raped or whatever they were writing on these boards. You know, in that way, when employers search for you, the first thing they don't, you know, the first thing they see is not all these horrendous things about you. So I think collective efforts like that can be incredibly helpful practically and can also make women who are being harassed feel, you know, feel supported and feel like they do have a community behind them. And when they have that sense of community, I feel like are a lot less likely to end up leaving the internet or quitting their blogs, you know, or just avoiding the whole situation. So you know, speaking out and actually taking some action are important. And I think also to address specifically Renee's question about women of color, really being cognizant of the way that race and gender play into internet harassment. We talk a lot about gender harassment. That's obviously a very important issue. But also looking at the way that bloggers of color are treated. Specifically, at least on my blog, I've seen female bloggers of color. When we have a guest blogger who self-identifies as a woman of color, the way that she gets spoken to is different in the comment section than how I get spoken to. I'm white. And I think just, you know, recognizing the fact that women of color are often criticized for their intelligence, their being, you know, too harsh, being too confrontational. The sort of very similar themes get repeated even in sort of non-harassing dialogues. And so keeping that at the forefront of the conversation as well, I think is really crucial, you know, in getting to the heart of this and combating it.
I mean, before we go back to the these emails and the phones again, what Renee called in about, Danielle, I just wonder, there are no laws that govern this. So, I mean, how do people organize themselves around this, A, on the web, but B, the whole idea of being able to fight it legally? Because if nobody takes it seriously, other than people who are being attacked, where do you go?
Yeah. So, I mean, there are laws that we can invoke, but they're underutilized. So we can certainly look to tort law. But of course, tort suits are very expensive. So intentional infliction of emotional distress and defamation
are hard to prove.
They're hard to prove. They're very expensive also to pursue. And at the same time, prosecutors, because there aren't offline, oftentimes there may not be offline stalking and real physical violence, prosecutors don't take this seriously. And so I think that we need to start thinking about this in terms of civil rights questions and invoke Title VII when women bloggers, their blogs are shut down, income-generating blogs are shut down.
Shut down by who?
Groups like Anonymous, who their sole mission is to shut down, you know, with technology, using image raping that
you don't mean the people who own the place where the website lives is shut down. You're talking about people who attack websites and literally shut them down.
Literally shut them down with what Jill talked about, image raping, repeatedly refreshing the images on someone's sites to use up all of its allocated monthly bandwidth and shut it down. And if a group like Anonymous engages in this, I mean, they've apparently taken credit for shutting down over 100 women's issues websites, feminist websites. If those women can't pursue, either make a living online, like Kathy Sierra shut down her blog, she can't enhance her reputation in the technical community anymore, I'd argue that that constitutes a civil rights violation, that we ought to take seriously sort of the both moral and coercive power of those anti-discrimination message.
It seems to me in some ways, we're going to take a break here, but when we come back, I mean, I want to read the other emails that have come in and thank Renee so much for being part of the show and bring some other people to join us here at 410-319-8888. If you've experienced cyber harassment, if you've been part of this kind of cyber war taking place against women and against non-white people on the web, we'd love to hear your stories and thoughts at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Seems to be a day for emails more than calls, which is fine. We'll be right back, and we're going to explore some more of this in greater depth. Stay with us. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. We're talking about cyber sexual harassment on the air today, the intensity with which women are attacked in very visceral and disgusting ways on the web. Not just that, but how when we think of hackers going after businesses, but these are hackers who are going after to shut down women's websites and feminist websites and non-white people's websites on the air. Your thoughts at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. And we're in the studio is Danielle Citrone, who is professor of law at the University of Maryland School of Law, whose research looks at cyber gender harassment and the hostile environment that women face online. LaToya Peterson joins us by phone. She's a Silver Spring-based blogger whose work can be seen on her site at racialicious.com. I encourage you to go there as we speak to see what she does there. She's the editor of that site. Her writing appears in the recently released anthology, Yes Means Yes, Visions of Female Sexual Power and a World Without Rape, as does her other guest's writings, Jill Filipovich. She's also blogs at feministe.us, feministe.us. You can check that out as well as we speak to the women on the air today. Her writing has also appeared in Huffington Post, Alternet, The Yale Journal of Law and Feminism, and many other places. 410-319-8888. Let me read some questions that came in. When we're talking about, you don't know who you're really talking to on the web. So we have an email here that is actually directed at you, Jill. That's, we think, from a woman, but who knows what this anybody's handle could be anything, right? She says, and I was looking at what she was referring to on the web here, and she says, why should we worry about attacks on her being Jill Filipovich, when her blog hosts such nasty attacks on other women, and some are written by anonymous bloggers? For example, she cites one on the web, on feministe.us, as dawn-eden-nasty-little-piece-of-work, or the thrill of the chaste introduction and chapter one. Isn't she rather a hypocrite to complain when nasty things are posted about her if her blog is going to do it on the attack like this?
Well, I think there's a difference between substantively criticizing what someone else has written. Dawn Eden is a Christian blogger, conservative, wrote a book about maintaining your virginity until marriage. And Dawn actually, I think, is a very nice person, and I've emailed with her. We have written things criticizing her book and criticizing some of the things that she's written, and very much calling into question her worldview, which I fundamentally disagree with, as she fundamentally disagrees with mine. Dawn has written about me as well. I never considered it a personal attack. I don't, as far as I know, Dawn has not considered anything that I've ever written about her a personal attack. So I think that we can draw a pretty bright line between criticizing someone's ideas, criticizing what someone writes, engaging with other ideas, having political debate and conversation, and saying that somebody should be raped and killed. I would never in a million years write something like that about anyone. I don't think anyone here is suggesting that women online need to be treated with kid gloves, or that you can't question what we say, or that you can't argue with us, or that you can't vigorously criticize us. I think that's all within the realm of what's fair game. I think what's not fair game is, photoshopping a noose next to someone's head or publishing their home address, or saying that someone has STDs or,
right.
you know, the whole slew of those things.
I've been reading, I mean, when the email came in, I went right to the web to kind of read what she was talking about, or this person was talking about when she wrote in, but I can see the discussion you're having here is like, it literally is, that is a discussion, and if it's attack, it's on ideas that someone has, and not about, and not attacking a woman as a woman.
Right.
So there's a huge difference, I think.
And that's like the trivialization of the attacks on Jill, to suggest that her criticism of somebody's ideas, to equate that with the kind of harassment that Jill suffered, it trivializes it and says, look, it's harmless. It's like anyone's criticism of anyone's ideas. And I think that in itself is a major problem.
Let me read this other email that came in from Harriet in Mount Vernon. Harriet writes in, I'd like to hear the panelists discuss organizations like Blogger, B-L-O-G-H-E-R, and Blogging While Brown, to feel that these groups are making an impact in changing the hostile environment women often find online. Are they seeing movement on this issue in some kind of bigger blogs like Daily Kos? It's disappointing that even in cases where overt harassment is not taking place, the situation online can be very hostile. One of the top blog networks is Gawker Media. Their flagship blog just fired their latest female writer, and when female readers protested, male commentators responded with scorn, saying that, quote, the Gawker Media blog, Jezebel, is written by women for women. Go over there if you want to read female writers and stop complaining. It was ridiculous and very disappointing, this idea that all female issues and the female writers should be sectioned off into this little area while the big boys can get the real work done with their real resources. I think back to early internet communities like The Well, which demanded users identify themselves by their real names. Stuff like this doesn't happen here, or happens very rarely. Who'd like to grab that one first?
I can talk about...
Danielle, go ahead.
I'd like to just respond to, you know, whether we're seeing improvement on, you know, sites like Daily Kos. And I think the answer is absolutely not. Political blogs are sort of rife with attacks on named women, but then just, you know, very insensitive and comments about women. In fact, I think the operator of Daily Kos, Marcos Melitos, in response to the attacks on Kathy Sierra, said that she was making them up and she should stop being such a crybaby and simply she should just go offline if she can't stand the heat. So I think that though Blogger does great work, often the problem is, you know, we have a collective action problem. It's difficult to get it all to respond to these attacks on all women. I mean, Jill was lucky to have people help her in Google bombing, but the better part of most women, as LaToya says, go offline or assume gender-neutral pseudonyms.
What seems to me is you and Jill, and I think I have this right, Jill Filipovich, you two of you wrote about this woman that I was reading about in your work today, Jessica Valenti?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I haven't written about Jessica, but Jill has, right?
And she's the woman who was part of Daily Kos. Do I have her? I'm mixing up with somebody else.
No, Jessica Valenti is a blogger at feministing.com.
Feministing.com, okay. So let me take that back. Come back to Jessica in a minute. The question I have is Daily Kos.
Yeah.
Is supposed to be this progressive blog site that is touted by everybody in Denver when we were covering the Democratic National Convention. They were all over the place. Pushing progressive issues.
Yeah.
So it seems to me that in some ways, maybe, is this the place to push? Is this, how do you push places like Daily Kos, which should not be that way?
Yeah. And especially their leadership thinks that what happened to Kathy Sierra is a joke. You know, it's sort of child's play. That's problematic. If the leadership, you know, some of the helm doesn't take it seriously, then I think we've got to work on having them take it seriously.
Thanks, Mark.
I was bringing you right back in. Go ahead, LaToya.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the interesting things that I've learned being a progressive woman of color blogger and writer is that not to assume that a progressive community will be any more welcoming to what you're saying than a conservative community, which sounds shocking on its face, but at the same time, it doesn't mean that progressives want to understand and tackle issues like racism, sexism, classism, ableism within their ranks. And a lot of times what you get is a lot of denials, a lot of runarounds, or the cop-out questions. You know, if more women were writing about politics, then we'd post them. But since no women are writing about politics, we can't post anything, you know, which is blatantly untrue. But there's this perception that colors a lot of progressive spaces, that, you know, we've already gone past all of these things. We understand how important it is. We saw how racism was in the 60s. We understand how important the environment is. And we don't really need to look at how these problems are manifesting now and what's happening. I do believe in pushing leadership and start pushing out the doors and being like, you need to include these perspectives. You need to include our voices. But at the same time, sometimes I do find it a little bit easier to drop back into our own respective communities for strength. Like, that's one of the things that I do a lot with Racialicious, is to make sure that POC voices are heard. And maybe it's not always to everyone's satisfaction, but we do try to center POC voices, because in so many other corners of the blogosphere, people of color, particularly women of color, are marginalized. We also find ourselves facing double marginalization, because they're not going to listen to you because you're a woman. They're not going to listen to you because you're of color. Yeah. You put it all together, it's like, who's going to listen? Who cares? And so I feel like there is some gatebreaking that needs to happen, and gatebreaking goes on when you consistently produce your work, put it out there, and are willing to kind of face the fray of people arguing with you and back and forth and trying to take down your ideas based on your identity, but also building strong coalitions within your own community and using that to lift and build with each other.
Before I go into the question that that Harriet raised about a blog her and blogging while brown, which I want to come to, and folks, we're talking about sexual cyber harassment, what happens on through the internet, on people's websites, the attacks on women, the attacks on women's websites, the attacks on websites of people of color being shut down by the people who know how to manipulate the net and literally creating cyber wars. And your own experience with that at 410-319-8888, your thoughts and questions about that, or write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. We'll come back to the emails that are on our desk as well. But I wonder what it says to you, three, about if this is going on the web in such an intense way, and we're not paying attention to it, and we're not seeing it, because the statistics that you raised, Danielle, in your paper that I read, that once it gets published, we can all read. I can't remember the rest of the world to be able to read your paper.
One of them's on BU Law Review. It's on SSRN, but the other is going
to
be a book.
Right, and we can't wait to see that. And so then we'll have you back for that. But what's it say about the nature of the society that this is taking place in a place where anonymity, I was trying to get to earlier, that anonymity is a way of life? And that what comes through then. I mean, I was thinking about this the other day. I was reading the paper when Sheila Dixon, as the mayor here in the city of Baltimore, was indicted. And when I read the postings from suburban Maryland in the newspaper about Sheila Dixon, they were so blatantly racist.
Yeah, like virulent.
It just blew my mind. They were virulent.
Yeah.
So, and you can be anonymous when you post those blogs.
Yeah.
Nobody knows who you are. So I'm saying, I wonder what the three of you think about what this is saying about who we are and what's lying beneath the surface and how we have to get to this. What do we do about it? Why don't we start with our phone guest, Jill Filipovich and LaToya Peterson, then we'll go to Danielle. Jill?
Well, I think, you know, one thing that's interesting about at least the history of not just the United States, but, you know, England and generally the culture that we come from, is that women's public presence has sort of long been associated with sexual availability. And, you know, the public woman initially was always sort of thought to be a prostitute. Women out in public, unaccompanied, you know, it has this long history and lots of baggage. And, you know, I think that still comes through today. You see women on the street being sexually harassed by men as sort of a way of discrediting them and making them feel like they have less of a right to move through public space than men do. You know, you see women that are outspoken publicly, female politicians, being called whores, you know, to discredit them. Mm-hmm. So a lot of these kind of long-standing cultural assumptions, I think, still come into play online. And is part of the reason why the harassment of women, you know, isn't just about violence, but is often about sexual violence. You know, and it's so, so heavily sexualized in a way that threats against men online just aren't. I was speaking to one blogger, and she has two different email addresses. One, you know, is a gender-neutral one, and one has her name, which is a notably female name. And she said one thing that really strikes her is the difference in the emails that the hate mail that she gets. The one to the gender-neutral name is, you know, you're, you know, an a-hole, and I hate you, and you should die.
Hmm.
And the one to the female name is, you know, you're a B-word and I want to rape and kill you. You know, and just sort of the difference in that and how women specifically are threatened with sexualized violence, you know, I think is not surprising given the way that women are treated in our society generally.
LaToya Peterson?
It's not surprising at all to see these kind of sentiments echoed online. And, you know, I would even argue that it's not worse than it is in real life. People just perceive the social penalties as worse. Most people realize that going out into the world and saying something blatantly racist or saying something disgustingly sexist will possibly get them in trouble, but that filter is taken away online. What are you worried about? You can just say what you want. And a lot of times, sometimes a lot of people just do it because they feel as though they want to agitate. A lot of people do feel very powerless in their actual lives, in their real lives, and feel like they're squelching themselves or whatever. So when they go online, they really want to let loose. They really want to be provocative. They really want to disrupt the space and just be able to say and do whatever they want. And it's one of the reasons why we have comment moderation on my site, because it's almost impossible to have a decent conversation about race when everyone's at different levels of investment. If you have someone coming in who just wants to stir things up and yell out obscenities, you know, then it derails people who actually do want to have this conversation.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of anonymity and the web, I'm not 100% sure that removing the anonymity would solve the problem. So, you know, like I said, I blog under my real name. I don't have a problem with that. I do realize, though, that for many people, the anonymity allows them to express themselves in a way that they could not due to work constraints or family constraints, particularly a lot of women who want to talk about things like sexual abuse, sexual harassment, racial abuse and racial harassment. Even with their friends, I receive letters from people all the time who don't know how to talk to a family member who said something hideously racist, or a friend that they've had and they had a falling out with, or a boss that, you know, said something completely racist after a staff meeting, but they wouldn't ever want their boss to know that they know and want to say something about it.
Mm-hmm.
And so in that case, anonymity is really valuable on the internet because it allows people with shared experiences to come and connect without necessarily revealing themselves and paying whatever social cost they might have to pay in real life. So perhaps, you know, anonymity and being able to track people's IPs and things like that is important on the internet. But it's also equally important to look at, I think, more of what the root cause of all this resentment is. Why do people feel as though they want to let loose online? And why do they feel as though there's no consequences? And why is it that if you do something like this in a community, you aren't penalized? Because on racial issues, again, also due to heavy moderation, but on racial issues, if you make bigoted comments, our readers kind of just shun you. They don't want to talk to you anymore. They figured out that you don't want to engage, and they don't want to engage with you. But on video game communities, you know, and on threads like Kotaku, it's totally fine. Or, sorry, on sites like Kotaku, it's totally fine to be racist. It's totally fine to say something sexist because no one will call you on it, and someone will probably make a joke about it.
Mm-hmm.
So some of it is just the attitude of that community. And, it's, you know, I feel like it is also a heavy responsibility of moderators and people who host online communities to set the tone for what is and what isn't acceptable.
Yeah, I really found your website, by the way, really interesting. Both Feminist and Racial Issues are really fascinating sites. One day we'll just have to do some programs just on the sites and the stuff you all talk about. I think that just will cause a lot of discussion. But I wanted to get the phones here. Some people are calling in, but let me let Danielle respond as well, if you'd like.
Yeah, so Mark, you asked, you know, so what does this say about us? And I think what it suggests is that, you know, as a historical matter, we just haven't come as far as we think we have. That, you know, when we're cloaked in anonymity, you know, we're back to being as racist and sexist and really hateful and physically just terribly violent in a way that we think we have come a long way since, you know, since the 1960s. And I think maybe we can make the case for we have just not have come as far as we think we have in terms of our progress. And, you know, LaToya, you raise a great point about why people are doing this. I'm constantly asked whenever I give my cyber civil rights talk why individuals are doing this online. And some of what Martha Nussbaum at University of Chicago Law School noted at a conference that she had there was that this notion of Nietzschean notion of ressentiment, that people just feel resentful And it makes them feel powerful to put other people down, sort of rip down other people. And I think in an age where, you know, we're really, you know, suffering economically, we're seeing people lose their jobs, I think we probably can all predict that we're going to see it certainly become much worse, cyber harassment, for people to make themselves feel better, you know, for successful women like LaToya and Jill to be put down online and sort of, I would never want this to happen to you, but I imagine that it's just going to get worse for women. And African Americans online, women, you know, black women online.
Let me know the phones. We talk about cyber and sexual harassment on the air this hour. 410-319-8888. We're talking with Daniel Citrone, LaToya Peterson, and Jill Filipovich. And Halim in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Yes, how you doing?
Well,
good. Hello. Good. Well, hey. You know, I've listened to the show, and this seems like an exaggeration to me. You know, when Kwesi Mfumi ran for the Senate, he was called a dog by many women, that he was a dog. And I don't think those women who called him a dog considered that sexual harassment or that they raped him. When the gentleman from the Naval Academy, the quarterback, was accused of rape by one of the midshipmen's and the deep soccer players accused by rape. I didn't hear the feminists coming out to defend these innocent men. You know, you become more credible for me, and I believe others, when you can defend the honor of men as profoundly as you can women.
Okay, Halim, let me ask you, we only have a few minutes left, and this happened the last couple of days, the very last minute, calls come flooding in before the end of the hour. You can all call a little earlier. We can get into the discussion, but now we're nearing the end of the hour. But who wants to grab that one? Whoever left can grab that.
Oh, I'll grab that one. This is LaToya at WUSR. Just so you know, I always love the argument that comes back, you know, why are feminists not defending men? You know, why? How dare you not say anything about the men who are, you know, are accused of rape when they didn't do it and what happens? We take care of that within our communities. We do. But here's something that I do ask. I wrote an essay called The Not Rape Epidemic for Yes Means Yes. And it talks all about all the sexual assault, coercion, and sexual harassment women face that doesn't fall under the realm of rape, and how so many of us don't tell because there's too much of a stigma involved, because men like you will not believe us, because there is too much pain involved when you're just trying to move forward with your life. So most of us just let it go. They say that the sexual assault statistics for black women are 2 in 3. 2 in every 3 black women are sexually assaulted, and most of us don't tell. When I wrote that essay, I posted the original version on my website because I wanted as many women to read it as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And after that happened, 70,000 people viewed that essay, read it, wrote about it, and woman after woman after woman wrote in and told me about their stories and their pain. Never said. So I know this does not answer the question to your satisfaction, but I'm saying that in our society as it stands, just whenever you bring up something that happens to blacks, and whites are always looking at that one or two other instances when a white person was accused of something and they can't believe it, and blacks always remember all the instances when we were accused of something falsely and that it wasn't supported and we were convicted anyway, it's the same thing. It's the same thing with women. We all deal with it. Most of us never say a word at all. So while you can think of maybe 5 or 10 examples of men who have been falsely accused of something, I can think of literally 100 women, and I can point to you on my website of 200 women who all wrote in to tell me they never told their stories.
We have time. We have one quick call here. I just want to get. Can we have time for that? A quick call and one quick response. Christian, you're on the air, but a very quick thought, so we want to get a quick response.
Yeah, I just wanted to make a quick comment about, I think, the violence, bigotry, and racism on the internet, or, you know, violent-themed ideas, in a lot of cases are of the younger crowd, and it's sad because the younger crowd today seems to be a lot more progressive, obviously, than than their parents. But at the same time, you do have some of the more vehement racial parents that are going to instill those values in their children, and that's the way it's coming out. So, in my opinion, it's sort of the flame burning its brightest before it goes out. Like,
Christian, there's a really interesting thought, but I have less than a minute left. I'm going to turn to Danielle for a very quick response. Literally less than a minute left. I'm sorry.
I think I'm going to give it to LaToya.
LaToya, you seem to be the woman of the day here.
No, I'm not sure.
Definitely, I do agree with you that it is it's definitely the darkest before the dawn, and that this just new form of how people express racism is literally a form of how we've been taught how our society reinforces these bigoted assumptions like racism, classism, sexism, and things like that. But the more we challenge it and the more we say it's unacceptable, that's when we start making headway. And I feel like that's where we're heading.
Latoya Peterson, racialicious.com. Jill Filipovich, I'm sorry we didn't get you here in the last 5 minutes. Jill, feministe.us, check that out. And you can go on our website to read Danielle Citrone's Cyber Civil Rights. It'll be on our website for you to read. Thank you all three for joining us. We'll come back to this subject in some other creative ways. Thank you for being with us today. It's been great. The Mark Center Show is produced by Justin Levy and Jessica Phillips. We're engineered by Zachary Coleman. Our interns are Christina Arison and Judith Lloyd. Theme music by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again and podcast any of our past shows and additional interviews, you can hear them at steinershow.org. And for public radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.